Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads, featuring illuminated manuscripts, metalwork, carvings, and works by contemporary Ethiopian artists. On view now. For tickets and more information, you can visit PEM.org.
And Eastern Bank, committed to helping people and businesses prosper by investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Jared Bowen. Goodbye, si se puede. Hello, no you can't. Last week, in another setback for organized labor, Supreme Court of the United States voted 6-3 along traditional lines to restrict union representatives and their ability to organize farm workers. Join us on the line for his take on this, what the implications are, and the obstacles on the grocery-to-table movement is Corby Kummer. Corby, of course, is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello there.
Hello there.
Hi, Corby. So food banks, we've kind of understood them until this year to have a particular job, which is to take in food, take in donations. You have volunteers and then distribute food to the community or provide it for people who come and gather. But why and how are food banks beginning to rethink what they are and what they should be doing after the pandemic?
You know, first of all, it's such a good question. Second, there's a Duke Policy Center that did a survey of food banks during and after the pandemic. And they are finally getting on board with the idea that what are the root causes of this hunger? Rather than just saying it's intractable, we're going to deliver meals to as many people as we can, make it as efficient as possible, get as much money as we can. What are we going to do about actual distribution? What happens when we don't have as much money as we do during and after the pandemic? And how can we help the reality of people's needs? And what they're looking at is things like, well, first of all, in the short term, pandemic EBT benefit extensions, universal school lunch. These are things that the study from the Duke World Law Food Policy came out with that really should continue for months and years to come. But second, how do you really help reevaluate the whole food bank experience? One of the ideas is allow people to shop for what they want. Don't just give them what you're able to get. Find out from them what they want, what they need. Make it easy and dignified for them to be able to get there, for example, at night. The hours should suit them, not the staff of the food pantry. You should have the food pantry guests, as they're called, educate the people who operate the food pantry on what they need and when they need it. This is sort of a whole, I'm doing a big project on food as medicine research, and the wave of the future is go to the community first and find out what they need. Don't design something you think will be good for them.
You know, speaking of food as medicine, we talked about a year or so ago about how some doctors were trying to prescribe nutritional, literally prescribe nutritional food as something that should be covered because it was as important to the health of their patient as, you know, typical meds were. Is that going anywhere, or is that sort of like a on the margins kind of interesting story only?
No, it's going to keep going. You know, the research is slow on all of it. There are different kinds of prescriptions, but for example, produce prescriptions, which is one of the best things there is right now because it allows access to subsidized fresh produce, that's going far. There's lots of work being done on produce prescriptions. It's really good.
Talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy.
So, Corby, it's always kind of fun when you're in the supermarket and you see something you recognize from a favorite chef or a favorite restaurant. I mean, you just get so excited. At least I do, right? Because you think, wow, they've done this. This is huge. They're huge now. But what is that process to take some product that is very successful, let's say product or dish or something that's very successful in your restaurant, but bring it to the supermarket?
you know, there's many slip twixt hummus and lip. In the case of this story by Jane Black, former food editor of Boston Magazine. So let's have a little local interest right here, who writes beautiful articles for The Times, for The Washington Post. She's based in Washington. This is about what did it take for Little Sesame, a terrific chain that had established itself for very good Middle Eastern food, served to workers in downtown Washington. Well, how could they package up their hummus? And so it's very entertaining. There's larger points, which I'll get to. But the entertaining part is, how do you make it? How do you make the chickpeas not taste too acidic or too soapy? And I think the answer was you put them into a pressure cooker and then you can season them with real lemon juice. Because if you use baking soda, as lots of people, Jim, I'm sure you make your own chickpeas, which take 3 to 4 hours, mm-hmm. and you soak
I've
them overnight first.
I've actually made hummus. Thank you very much, Corby.
See, there
That's
you
excellent.
Are. And do you recall the baking soda part?
No.
It was frequent in the production at the Little Sesame chain, but when they pasteurized it, which you have to do for food safety rules, suddenly that baking soda made it taste very sour. So they kept experimenting. So it's tricks to figure out how to make something palatable and look good, because there was a weird slick during the pasteurization method they chose, which is high pressure, that is much less destructive to flavor than high heat. But what it did was oddly create this weird slick at the top of the package when people opened their container of hummus. So what they decided was, we'll put a little tomato jam on the top of this, because that won't look bad when people open it. It won't look yucky. It'll look like delicious tomato jam on top of their hummus. But in any case, very entertaining story about what it was like for Little Sesame to package its hummus. And now you can all go into Whole Foods and look for it. The larger question is, this was a way to increase income. And I think we'll be talking about, well, restaurants now have to turn away the go orders that kept them alive now that they're reopening. But what are restaurants going to do to stay alive after the pandemic? You know, and one of the new revenue streams was a packaged food product.
You know, speaking of Whole Foods, Margaret, I used to believe everything I heard on a radio show if I respected the people on it. But I'm listening to this radio show last week. Actually, I had you on it, Corby, now that I think about it. It was hosted by Marjorie Egan and Jared Bowen or something.
Right, now I'm in trouble, too.
And you guys were talking about something called Not Milk, a new product. And we've talked about oat milk, we've talked about pea milk, whatever. And Not Milk sold at Whole Foods. That's the name of the thing. Apparently, the name, clever, because it's not milk. But according to the experts, not you guys, but I think the people quoted in the New York Times story, said it tastes exactly like milk. Well, I learned after buying it, you know why it's called Not Milk? Exactly, because it tastes nothing like milk. Now, the good news, since you're asking for a product review, Corby, I can see it on your face. Unlike what the New York Times said, that when you put it in your coffee, it curdles. They didn't use the word curdle, but it separates or whatever that means.
Yeah.
Didn't separate at all. I put it directly in hot coffee. Then I put it in cold coffee, put it in the microwave. I was doing a real experimentation. It didn't curdle. And it's okay, but let me be the first to say on this particular program, Not Milk doesn't taste anything like milk. It is white and not gray, but it tastes nothing like milk. What do you think about that for a review, Corby Kummer?
Very accurate, and I intend to try to duplicate your results. I hope this is not part of the Journal of Irreproducible Results. But what about Oatly? What about other or almond milk or soy silk?
I can't get
that. Have
them.
You tried those?
I've tried every one. The only one I haven't tried, you mentioned about 6 months ago, pea
Rippled?
Milk. No, pea. And then I totally forgot about pea as
the
in
the brand
green
name
pea.
Is Ripple. It's made
oh, is that
out
what
of,
it is?
Yeah.
How Ripple. Is that?
I don't dare say I thought it was good in front of you, Jim, now that you're not milk is not milk for a reason, Jim. But I'd like you to try it and then tell me.
I will. I will try it before next time. We're talking to Corby Kummer and your favorite food reviewer. That's me, Jim Browdy. Oh, and Jared Bowen's here, too.
Well, Corby, I think we may have spoken to you about this just as it was kind of filtering out, but has there been any update on, and actually we were talking about this earlier in the show too, in the arts and how money from the government is not filtering down to the arts, money that's intended for restaurants to help them get through the pandemic, money that restaurateurs were counting on, had banked on practically, not coming to them has there been any resolution here? And just remind us why this has come to pass.
This is the blood-curdling story that shows us the Trump era is not over and the divisions in this country have not stopped. Why do I start with that grandiose opening? Because here's what the new Restaurant Revitalization Fund, administered through the Small Business Administration and passed in March, was supposed to do. It was a major victory. The Independent Restaurant Coalition, led by people including Amanda Cohen, who's going to figure in this story at Dirt Candy, a vegetarian restaurant in New York, had for a full year said, restaurants need money, they need financial help, they need billions of dollars from the government, $28.6 billion just for restaurants in the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. This was the biggest victory ever. And then, to make it even better, the Biden administration said, we are first going to open all applications to women, people of color, and veterans. They were shut out of the Paycheck Protection, the PPP Act, the first time. Big businesses snuck in and they vacuumed up the money. We're not making that mistake again. We're going to prioritize women, people of color, and veterans. And white-owned restaurants, goaded by fronts, including Stephen Miller, the odious former Trump advisor, found some white restaurant owners to say, hey, this is prejudice. I'm not going to get in the back of the line just because I'm white. I need this money just as much as anyone else did. And in the case of some of the white owners, they did need the money as much as anyone else, but they were able to get a ruling that put a halt to all of the pending applications, because of course, all of them went, all the money went pretty soon. And then people like Amanda Cohen and Dirt Candy had done a victory dance, because not only in her case was she one of the leaders who got this passed, but she was also approved for her loan application. And other people that we've read about, people of color, veterans, women. And then they got a just kidding memo from the Small Business Administration saying, we're sorry, this ruling has made us, has forced us to reevaluate all the applications in a sort of blind to whether you checked the box for Asian. So a story in the Boston Globe by Janelle Nanos and Anissa Gardisi really, really well reported, quotes people as saying, no, this isn't happening and we're not getting this. And it's, you know, it's an outrage. It's a reversal of what the intentions of the Biden administration were.
Well, can we continue the bad news just for a second? The Supreme Court, fairly predictably, six conservatives versus three liberal-leaning justices, knocked down a provision that gave organizers access to farm workers that essentially was pretty critical in an industry where it's very hard to reach people and they're seasonal and that sort of thing. Briefly describe it, and less briefly describe what you perceive to be the impact, Corby Comer.
So union organizers were going onto farms at 5 a.m. before the actual shifts, and with megaphones they were trying to drum up support for union organization. And part of this was they were given rights by a California law that was enacted. I don't find the date right now in the story, but it was to overturn the federal law in the 1930s that gave union access to the worksite, but excluded farm workers right, exactly. Out of sheer racism. And so California had tried to protect and make up for this by allowing farm workers after Cesar Chavez and the 60s strikes, United Farm Workers. It said migrant workers, all workers should be allowed to hear unionization messages. And several large packers sued, appealed, brought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and 6-3, the Supreme Court said, that's right, that's invading the personal property, the private property of these farm producers, and out unions. But Jim, I expect you to be, with your union organizational skills and background, completely outraged by this.
It is a disaster. And by the way, we should be clear that the statute that Corby's talking about, the California statute, only had allowed access to organize. It was at non-work times, before work, lunch hours, afterwards. It didn't impact the work of any of the farm workers in these places. And as well, John Roberts in his majority decision talked about it as an invasion, as you said. I think it was Steve Breyer, the Cambridge Associate Justice in the Supreme Court, who basically said it's nothing like an invasion. It is a temporary access to their property so that the workers hear arguments which the employer can cause them to hear 24/7 about their rights as workers to organize in this country. It's a disaster. We're talking to Corby Cohn. We got to move to one other thing, though, before you go, Corby, because we're short on time. Are you, as someone who's been writing about and involved in the food industry forever, do you think it is required that if a major chain, a worldwide chain, thousands of outlets, advertises a tuna sandwich? I want you to listen to this question carefully because it's an important and difficult one. Is it necessary that there be any tuna in the tuna sandwich? You can start with a yes or no and then explain why I'm asking if you'd like. Is it a requirement?
Yes, okay.
Yes, okay.
Are you
We're
happy
not that
now?
Short on time.
Why am I asking that question, Corby Cohn?
Because the New York Times did a sting operation on Subway and said, we have sent out to a fancy DNA lab doing the PCR test samples from your so-called tuna subs. And nothing. There's nothing that is detectable as tuna. So USA Today did a fact check of this and said, well, you know, Subway is very plausible when they say it's because we denature the protein by heating it. And we heated it and we cooked it and we sent it out to our chains and our franchise locations. And it's tuna, but we denature the protein. You and your fancy DNA tests aren't going to find it, no matter how much you try to amplify the DNA, because we've denatured it in our cooking process. I think this was kind of silly because I believe it started out as tuna. What's more interesting is trying to hold Subway up to its claims about sustainability. And they say it's 100% sustainably caught skipjack and yellowfin tuna. And there's another court filing in which plaintiffs are saying, no, that's a lie. I'm much more interested in that. But I think there was tuna of a sort, Jib, in
this
sandwich.
What, did you do some DNA test on the damn tuna? How do you know what was in it?
Because I'm a scientific expert and I have reviewed all of the scans. And also there was a rival Inside Edition sent tuna samples from three New York Subway stores to a lab in Florida that specialized in conducting DNA testing of fish. And it found tuna in every single sample, all three of them.
Do you know what they should call these sandwiches, by the way, in the spirit of what we talked about earlier?
Not tuna.
Exactly. Exactly. Corby, it is great to talk to you. Thank you much for your time. I appreciate it. Not tuna with a side of nut milk. That is one fine lunch.
Which just sounds revolting anyway, tuna and milk. Well, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, Corby Cohn joins us regularly. He's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Well, coming up, we're asking you if the invention of reply all is the undoing of civilization,
yes,
or at least your own personal undoing. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.